And welcome, and I understand there are some who are joining us for the first time today, so we welcome you to join us at Sangha this morning. I'm very happy to be here this morning with a panel of three very deep practitioners, long-term practitioners, and also very dear friends, and to be sharing this topic that is so meaningful, I think, particularly now, of deep listening and loving speech. So Fred, our teacher, has just joined us a few moments ago with the students from the five-year Dharma Transmission Program, and some of you may not be aware, but we do have a program for a group of students who have really committed themselves to deep study, practice, realization of the Dharma with Fred, and they've just this weekend, with a retreat they've been on this weekend here at the Center with Fred, just completed their first full year of study. So we welcome and congratulate and bow to all of you. Yeah, wonderful. So Fred has often taught us in this hall that it's very difficult to practice mindfulness and to cultivate wisdom if our skillful actions are not present. In fact, if we have unskillful actions. So he's asked us to dedicate one sangha each month to really looking deeply and discussing one of the five, what the Buddha called the five precepts, which Thich Nhat Hanh calls the five mindfulness trainings. These are really how we practice living ethical lives. And they're not commandments. They're really invitations to use as guidelines to be inspired by, to practice with intelligence and sensitivity of how we live our life. Thich Nhat Hanh has formulated what, again, he calls the five mindfulness trainings, which are really a bit of elaborations around the Buddha's original five precepts. And he's reformulated those several times. So he had a first version, which was quite pithy. And today we have a third version, which is much more elaborated and actually quite helpful as we look in today's times, how do we study and practice these trainings? So today, again, we're looking at the fourth training, loving speech and deep listening. And I'd like to just share first the original version by Thich Nhat Hanh, which is what we use as a community when we twice a year transmit formally these trainings to those who really want to formally enter the Buddhist path of practice. And then I'll read the third version, the more elaborated version. Do not say untruthful things. Do not spread news that you do not know to be certain. Do not criticize or condemn things that you are not sure of. Do not utter words that cause division or hatred, and that can create discord and cause the family or the community to break. All efforts should be made to reconcile and resolve all conflicts. And now the third version, which interestingly, the third version moves, I think, a bit from loving speech to also include deep listening, so truly looking holistically at how we communicate. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I am committed to cultivating loving speech and compassionate listening in order to relieve suffering and to promote reconciliation and peace in myself and among other people, ethnic and religious groups, and nations. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I am committed to speaking truthfully using words that inspire confidence, joy, and hope. When anger is manifesting in me, I am determined not to speak. I will practice mindful breathing and walking in order to recognize and to look deeply into my anger. I know that the roots of anger can be found in my wrong perceptions and lack of understanding of the suffering in myself and in the other person. I will speak and listen in a way that can help myself and the other person to transform suffering and to see the way out of difficult situations. I am determined not to spread news that I do not know to be certain and not to utter words that can cause division or discord. I will practice right diligence to nourish my capacity for understanding, love, joy, and inclusiveness, and gradually transform anger, violence, and fear that lie deep in my consciousness. So obviously, as human beings, we have this capacity for speech and for listening. And this capacity for speech, I feel, really gives us a great responsibility and a great right to really practice this training. As we speak, sometimes I think we're not present to the fact that our words have such an impact on the hearts and minds of everyone who hears it, whether they're the words we speak, the words we write, how we communicate. So our words have the capacity to produce results in others that are wholesome, unwholesome, or perhaps neutral. Our words really have a ripple effect. So I know that as practitioners of the Dharma, we're very fortunate that we know this, that we can see and understand how important our speech and our listening is. And we can also recognize at the same time that there are many in the world who perhaps don't have this teaching. So may we serve as beacons with our speech and our listening to help others. So how we begin to practice, of course, really, as we're taught by Thich Nhat Hanh and others, really begins with us and our own hearts. And from there, it can move out into the world. So I'm, again, delighted that today we have three very experienced practitioners with us. Charlie Stewart, Marilyn Warlick, Lee Purser, who I know have each been practicing at least 20 years in this tradition. Charlie has many years of experience as a mental health counselor. He's also very involved in activities at the center, from overseeing the hall to helping co-lead mindfulness and meditation on Wednesday night with Darlene. Marilyn also, in her career as a social worker, working very much with hospice, with leading our death and dying effort here, has many years of deep experience as well. And Lee Purser, who has a very interesting background in Buddhism, having studied in India with the Dalai Lama and many other teachers, has also made many wonderful contributions here at the center, founded and leads our mindfulness and recovery program. So I welcome each of you, and each panelist will have about 8 to 10 minutes to share. I'll invite a little bell when you have about a minute left, and I thank you again. Charlie, if you would begin.
Thank you. Dear friends, it's so nice to be with you this morning. It was really a very nice, very educational for me to just look deeply at this practice, the five mindfulness trainings, and especially that of loving speech. I realize that the five mindfulness trainings are more than just rules of etiquette or courtesy. They're a reflection of how life really is. They're a mirror of what's true and what's real. And as such, practice of these mindfulness trainings takes us from mere compliance to a deeper understanding of what we're about and how we can make this world better. As I looked at the mindfulness training on loving speech, I realized that I was very aware of the impact of speech in my life from the time that I was a child. And that would happen when my parents would start to bicker, or my sister, who was older and a teenager, would get in a fight with my parents. And you could feel the disturbance. You could feel the tension. And I suffered. You know, I could feel it. And it didn't seem like it had to be that way. And I would ask, you know, I didn't ask out loud, but inside it was like, why do people have to do this? And so as a child, I made a promise to myself that I wouldn't act like that. However, I became an adult. And found myself doing the same darn thing. In fact, acting much like my parents acted. And so that caused me to look deeply at what was going on. That caused questions to come to my mind about, why do I do this? Why do other people do this? And so it's actually, you know, these trainings cause us to reflect on our lives. if we don't just try to comply and then give up and then, just try to push away if we fail at it, just push away the results. If we don't do that, but we look and see what this didn't work. Why didn't it work? What's going on in me, and the other person, but especially me. What's going on in me that it didn't work? And so, coming to the Dharma was a wonderful thing because then it began to point out exactly what was going on. And one of the first things I ran into was ego, you know? And I learned very early that the philosophy of the ego was I'd rather be right than happy. And so when I get into an argument with Darlene, my most loved person in my life, part of me wouldn't want to give up, and part of me would want to be on top and control and would say things that were just not helpful or supportive of her in order for me to maintain my position. So ego, or clinging to that idea of self, was the first thing I began to see and start to practice with and realize that that had to be loosened up in order to truly practice loving speech on a continual basis. The next thing I ran into was just simple habit energy. You know, you do things over and over again, and it's easy to repeat them. And not only habits that I created in myself, but habits that I'd picked up from my parents. And my mother tended to be a slightly perfectionistic, critical person. So the first thing that would come to her mind when she was ostensibly trying to help somebody was, what's wrong with this picture? You know, how could you be better? And I incorporated that, you know. My mother is a part of me, you know, this truth that our ancestors are a part of us, that's right there for you to look at. So then I had to practice not only for myself, but for my mother, so that together we could start to lighten up about how life should be lived. And then I came across this sense of I act, and the quality of my actions seem to be dictated by something other than my thinking. I can think of doing a good thing, I can think of saying a loving thing, but my state of mind will dictate what really comes out. Or if, you know, the right words can come out, but the wrong message is behind it, you know? I thought of it, it's like giving a diamond to your loved one, only you stick it in the middle of a can of garbage and say, here, I'm giving you this diamond, please dig it out. We just wouldn't do that, right? And the loved one might miss the point. So, a state of mind actually became a very important principle for me, because I could recognize that. I could recognize the feeling and when it was going in a direction that was not going to allow me to express love, or to express love verbally, or any other way. And lo and behold, you know, the state of fear was what would raise my ego. If my ego was there and clinging hold of me, it was usually because I was afraid or insecure. Afraid of losing approval, afraid of tarnishing my self-image. You know, something would keep me fighting. But it was just ego. And as I had the courage to let that go, then my actions would bring about the results that I wanted. And that's what I had to see at first. I had to look at and say, what do I value in these trainings? What do I want to do? Okay, this is what I value. And now I'm trying it, and I'm not doing it, and I'm trying it, I'm not doing it, but I still value. And so eventually it's like, okay, then I could catch it. I could catch something arising in me and stop it. You know, like the training says, when anger arises in me, I keep my mouth shut. It doesn't say that exactly, but I keep my mouth shut, realizing that this is a feeling coming out of a state of mind that has a totally destructive view. And if I hang on, this stuck state of mind will pass. If I hang on and calm and open my mind, this state of mind will calm, will pass, and I'll see a more open, loving way to approach it. And then the last thing is that finally, you know, finally it settles in. And when you maintain that loving state of mind and that open state of mind, or the mindfulness that we're all trying so hard to maintain from meditation, then it sort of becomes, you know, the training becomes an expression from inside. It's no longer a struggle to comply. It's an expression from inside. And so I can feel that. I can feel that there's more, the core in me is trained in that direction. Doesn't always happen. I've still got more training to do. I'm still practicing. But it's an inside job. And I've got to develop myself. And the trainings point me in the direction, and the Dharma gives me the tools. So.
Thank you, Charlie. Certainly one of the gifts as I sit here and listen is how wonderful to just hear fellow practitioners talk about the experience of living a mindful life. And my mind goes, oh yeah, that's right. Again, in our lives, we don't normally get to hear this type of sharing and speech of what reality and living in the moment looks and feels like. So thank you, and thank you all. I too, in reflecting on loving speech and deep listening, a recent teaching just popped out to me of a teacher quoted as saying, the most precious possession is our mind. And part of me laughed because that was the least precious possession I had at the start of coming into a practice. And indeed, a lot of anxiety and fear and a lot of creations the mind was just having a great deal of creativity with and causing a great deal of harm to myself and the blessed folks that were in my life drew me to the Dharma to learn how to slow this down at least, if not turn it off. So there was this sort of a battle, if you will, between it, whatever that unhelpful conversation going on, either in me or out there, those people who were saying or doing hurtful things to me, how could I change that? Because I did understand it was not working. And the first piece that was the tremendous gift was learning how to calm down. Sitting meditation for me was a piece that came welcomed. To sit in the morning was a blessed refuge to get enough skill that I could sit and calm. And that refuge felt so great that I attached to it. And I liked hanging out there. It was then walking into work or being with my loved ones that the same old behaviors popped back up. So as Charlie mentioned, it requires to then start looking a little more deeply and understanding what is the mind up to and understand what the capacity of the mind is, but also what the mind can take us down to. And I realize the momentum of these anger statements, of these fantasies that I continue to feed was a choice at one level, unconscious or conscious. And I realized the desire to understand that if I could understand and accept, I could then let go. And these words that were running in my head and heart would start to ease because I did believe the teachings. They made sense in that regard. At the same time, we call them masks. Some of Mara's masks were very apparent in my life, and two of them were doubt, which can come up as wisdom. What are they talking about? You know, that doesn't apply to me. And the other was sloth or torpor, which I did not want to think I was lazy. That's not me. But it would come up as, oh, you've worked so hard, give yourself a break, slip on back into that self-pity for a minute. You know, go ahead and ride that horse out of righteous indignation. You know, you just worn yourself out with this practice. And it took a great deal of repetitive coming back to the mat, going to retreats where I could have a container to calm down and listen, just as we're sharing here, of what practice looks like. A most recent example is the lovely guidance of Jacqueline this morning. I had just had a call from family of a member whose health is declining, and boy, did Mara jump up. Let me fix that. Let me make a few phone calls. Let me just get the social work hat on and let me just... da-da-da-da-da. Not helpful speech. Not loving speech. And enough of a practice and faith and devotion to come in here and just let the Sangha breathe with me and let the words of Jacqueline just nourish. And every time that thinking mind wanted to jump up, I see you, Mara. I see you, Mara. And about 15 minutes, and that ease and that calm. And so that skill and that ability to maintain concentration, attention, mindfulness, as the storm is happening in the body and mind, and it may just be habit energy coming up. It may be triggers from old fears or events in life that just pop for no reason, and the inner environment is just ready to fight or run or do something that's harmful. So that ability to just this and just be present and watch with those kind eyes and those kind, loving words from our teachers of it feels real, but is it true? Helped me a great deal to ride out the storms. And this week has had a few storms, and then this morning I got a wonderful new opportunity to look and watch as the storms can arise. So that importance to develop that capacity to concentrate and hold attention, which is the formal practice, no matter if it's 2 minutes or if it's a half hour, every day, is invaluable for that foundation. And the growth and the belief of the teachings and the three jewels of the Dharma, the Sangha, and our teacher. And to realize when that ego comes up and says, what are they talking about? You know, I'm not going to blindly follow this. Or whatever that doubt that comes up is that causes us to pause. Use attention and stability to look and see, is it true? This isn't about blind faith. It is about learning to look deeply at what's happened in my life at this moment and how can I step forward with loving kindness and compassion and wisdom to be of service to myself, to all beings, and to continue that motivation and keep it rich and alive. So the path then grew more and more to being conscious and aware of others as opposed to my world. And that, as the stability grew and the insight grew, then the ability to reach out and be with others in a compassionate, stable manner grew. And with that grew a sense of non-self, that I see myself in you. And of course you would act that way. I see myself in you. Me too. We all are one. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Charlie and Marilyn, and you too, Angie. This is the hardest training for me. And I was on the phone with my daughter yesterday, and she said, oh, good, Mom, you're talking about that. Maybe you'll learn it. well. first off, one bit in what Angie read, when anger is manifesting in me, I'm determined not to speak. Well, I didn't grow up that way. I grew up in a family that was angry and difficult at best. There was a lot of disapproval, not just of me, but of all sorts of things. And like Charlie, I learned that stuff. And even though I didn't want to be like that, I found myself like that. So I've, for a long while, had to work with being defensive. That's what we did in my family. The Dharma is the biggest blessing I have ever encountered in my life. It has and is giving me a chance to change the habits that are destructive, that keep me separate, keep me isolated, lose me friends. And I've done all of that. The good news is, you join a community like this one, and there's a lot of forgiveness here. That's not always true elsewhere, and it's true here. So I feel very safe to experiment and change some of these habits. Now, for sure, Fred pushes me along in this. I was just in empty cloud for a couple of days, and I mentioned to him that sometimes I have difficulty with conversations. And he pointed out something really wonderful to me, which is that, yeah, I have this great intention going into a conversation to stay mindful. I set my, especially one that I think might be difficult, I set myself up with my breath, I check out my body, and I listen. Well, then I forget. And he gently pointed out to me that if I instead stayed with that through the whole conversation, I wouldn't have to go back and make an apology. So I'm a slow learner. And that one's really stuck with me, and I thank you for that, Fred. I am practicing it, and I'm finding it difficult. You know, I mean, I really have it wired up in there that if I start out good, it'll be fine. So, and Thich Nhat Hanh said diligence. In the Tibetan tradition, it's joyous effort. And I'm a little happier with that word because I've had enough of the heavy words in my life. I grew up with them big time. So joyous effort about staying with each conversation all the way through is a big one for me. The next thing that comes to mind is Shantideva, and when in difficult situations, difficult conversations, act like a log. Now, we didn't do that in my family. I retaliated every bloody chance I got because, well, that was my safety. You know, I either blamed or lied or exaggerated or did whatever I needed to. Now, acting like a log, the first time I read that, I thought that was insanity. But you know, it kind of goes with deep listening. If I can't be a log, how can I hear you? You know? If I can't stay in touch with my breath and my body, how can I be with you? So, I'm not saying I'm any expert in this, because I'm not. I'm sure most of you have noticed that. But I'm working on it. And that act like a log is a really good thing for me to remember. The third thing that's been so useful to me in this mindfulness training is something that Ajahn Amro of the Ajahn Chah lineages said to me. We said to a bunch of us. And that is the practice of when you want to give feedback. Well, in my family, we did that. It wasn't really feedback, was it? It was yelling. So I needed a different system or a different habit that I could start moving towards. And he suggested the following, that I remember to ask myself before I said anything. Well, right there, that was a stopper. Is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? That's a real bugaboo. Is it the right time? Oh, boy. I'd rather do it when I'm angry. Yeah. Then the last one he said was the one that stopped him in his tracks for a long while. And this one he said, you're lucky, you're a layperson, it doesn't apply to you. Well, I take it pretty seriously. I'm not very good at it. But here's the last one. Have you completely conquered this fault in yourself? Oh. So, it's nice to keep in mind, even if I'm not a monk or a nun, that who am I to give feedback if indeed I have the same fault? So, this, you know, this whole mindfulness training, is the good news about it is it goes on every day. You know, I recently just got a kitty, and I find myself saying, no. You know, and I'm going, oh, perhaps there's a nicer way to do this. So, at least that thought is coming to mind. And that's part of the joyous effort of it. Thank you.
So thank you so much to our three panelists. Would like to invite you to now just kind of reflect on what's been shared and any questions you may have that you'd like to ask the panelists. And if so, please just put your hands together or raise your hand and we'd love to hear your questions. Yes, thank you. And I'll just repeat for live stream. The question is, this has been a very emotional week for many of us. How do we engage? How do we practice in a skillful way, essentially?
Well, I can take the first shot at that, which is because it relates very much to my practice with states of mind. So this week, many of us didn't get what we wanted, and we're upset about that. And not only upset, but kind of frightened. And so the first thing we do is calm down. We realize these thoughts that are going through our minds and these judgments are creating a certain reality in us. And as we can either feed them or argue against them. Either way, we get held and we continue to be frightened. And so the first thing is to calm down. I know I can see this differently. And once I see it differently with a calm and open mind, then I'll know the things I need to do to act constructively in this situation. So the first is calming inside myself. So.
The only thing I'd add to that, Darlene, is that one thing I've noticed all over Facebook is people are way out in the future. And exactly what Charlie said, but just one third thing, is perhaps to stay in the present. How's this moment right now? Yeah.
Just to add to that is the importance of bringing practice into helping to come back to this moment. I know for myself, I did a lot of walking. I thought of the image of Ty after hearing tragic news of his beloved Vietnam or other incidents in his life, and he spoke about, for days or weeks, walking, mindful walking. And moments like this, I can get it at a microscopic level of how important that is, because unless I can stabilize myself with a practice, of what benefit can I be for right action that is so sorely needed at this time? So the importance to be in practice with that intention.
You know, Thich Nhat Hanh often, along those same lines, talked about the boat people leaving Vietnam and the panic as they were overcome by pirates and other problems, and how important it was that somebody was the calm person in the boat, how that one calm person could be the person that really kind of saves the group. And again, you know, as we said at the beginning, we have the Dharma, we have this practice, and there's no time like now to really practice deeply for the world, and to really... So I find it quite profound myself to be in this position. I'm wondering, Fred, is there anything you'd like to share?
Well, thank you all. Actually, I was enjoying sitting out here. I mean, to be honest, I mean, I really enjoyed looking at the altar and the Buddha, you know, really so beautiful, and the flowers and all of you, I mean, and just... Yeah, I enjoy this perspective. Yeah, so again, obviously a lot. I think this is so important. I mean, this training on right speech, on resolving all conflicts, however small, on seeing how anger contaminates our ability to do that. Again, it is, you know, we see the contamination in the public sphere, in the political sphere, in the societal sphere, of angry speech, hateful speech, divisive speech, disrespectful speech. I mean, it is an arena of wrong speech, and therefore it is causing suffering throughout our society, and makes our capacity to act in a meaningful and wise, intelligent way for the greater good very difficult. But unfortunately, what goes on in the public sphere is probably a reflection of what goes on in the very private sphere. That is why it behooves us, as individual practitioners of the path of loving kindness, and as a community that is doing their best to live in it, that we take this very seriously. In our personal relations, our interpersonal work, and now again, I don't—I'm not a social media junkie, but I hear about it, and I realize that that has become a great immediate avenue for just unintelligent, emotionally based speech. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh calls his book about the five mindfulness trainings, he calls it "For a Future to be Possible." It's really quite wonderful. You know, and like, you know, it's like these aren't just ethical teachings. They're really about the future of our planet, of our society. If we don't learn how, I mean, again, we've, you know, I mean, let's just take this fourth one. All five are meaningful. If we don't learn how to practice deep listening, and learn how to communicate in a clear and wise, intelligently, unemotionally laden way, you know, the significant problems that beset our society and the world will never be resolved if we can't communicate. As human beings, that is how we relate to one another primarily. We talk with each other. we communicate with each other. That's our primary way of relating. So this fourth mindfulness training is very significant. And before we can demand it of the world, before we can demand it of our political leaders, we need to make sure that we know how to do it. And that in our own, you know, even with our own inner dialogue, how we talk to ourselves, how we talk to our loved ones, how we talk to our friends, how we talk with our colleagues. And if you're on social media, how you, you know, really be aware of the effect of words. So that's all I need to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Good. I'd like to invite us now then. Oh, Andrew. Yes, wonderful. Thank you.
So I have an observation and a question about the log strategy. Because sometimes I guess I try to be like a log, but it turns into a battering ram. Because, you know, I might be upset, angry, righteously indignant, and decide I'm just going to be quiet. But I make it so obvious that I'm just keeping quiet, which makes me even more righteous. And then I might be asked, you know, what's going on with you? And I've said literally, well, I'm keeping quiet because what I'd really like to say So, you know, there's being a log that's really just part of the mulch, and then there's being like really obvious, and I want you to notice that I'm making a mindful effort to be quiet. You know, so, I mean, how does one do that a little more skillfully?
I'd like to take a shot at that, because I recognize that strategy. It's like, oh, well, if you really want to know, I'll tell you what I'm thinking. And it really depends on what I'm seeing at the moment. You know, am I seeing that what's arising in me is anger, resentment, hatefulness, fear? And if it's any of those things, do I want to express it? And if it's any of those things, where are they? Where are they hiding out in me? And what do I need to do to put the damper on them? Or to transform them, to change them in myself, you know? I need to immediately begin to change them in myself. I mean, sometimes I just have to excuse myself and leave the room, you know, because it, staying in the situation, I'll just keep grasping. So anyway, it's a deep looking, you know. And when it doesn't work out, you look again.
I like what Charlie said about, it's an inside job here. If I'm riled up and acting like a log while I'm riled up, it's probably not the best time to say anything. But I can say that. That's truthful. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's very useful. So that I'm human to somebody else. not perfect like I sometimes think I ought to be, you know? Then sometimes that breaks the ice between the two of us or whatever. And in fact, it usually does, and the other person says something actually from a different tonality, a different place, and we have the beginning of a different conversation.
Going into another room, and sometimes I really need to go to another room in my mind, and I need to do it about every other second, and I just wonder if you had you all have any suggestions about that, if that is that clear what the problem is, you know, where something's going on and it's rather obsessively repeating itself in your head and you'd very much like to calm down and go in another room, but it happening in your own mind. Any suggestions?
You know, one room that I go to that I find very helpful in my mind sometimes is the room of aspiration. It's a bigger room than the room of righteousness. And sometimes when that righteousness is, you know, it's if the thoughts keep going, I'm right, and it just keeps, you know, it's the wiping the blood clear with the bloody rag thing, with these thoughts just cycling. And I find if I can just move to the bigger room of, you know, how do I want this relationship to be? You know, how do I really want to be? A bigger picture for myself, a nobler picture, that room can help me let go of where I'm stuck.
Yeah, I just know I want out. I want out. And that obsession has been created by me and can be uncreated by me. And it's an interesting thing that my mind will do is like look for the best technique to get out. And while I'm looking, I'm still obsessed. Yeah. You know, and what's true is it's a release. It's a letting go. It's a calming down. It's whatever allows us to let go, you know? Just release the fist, release the mind, release it, release it. I just know I want out, and so I keep quiet and I practice the best way I can until it starts to lighten up. It will lighten up because I know everything is impermanent.
Yeah, I think it's years of practice and repetition of showing up in that room, so I'm starting to recognize whatever that unhelpful place is. So then there's a confidence and a faith that goes along with practice of this too will pass, this is not the time to speak, and what are the practices that are helpful or may be helpful, and then I'll just start having relationships with those practices. Oftentimes it's nature, walking and just the eyes see what they see. I go into the body sensations. I find that's a helpful check for me of separating, over-identifying. And breath is just so wonderful, and the eyes see what they see, and the ears hear. And just repeating that practice generally helps me ease up that tunnel vision that I've gotten myself into.
That room you're talking about. What's helpful for me is to ask the question, and it comes from Fred, what is this? What is this room that I'm finding so solid that's running me? And look directly at it, because it's not real. I've just made this story up that there's a room that's running me, that, you know, that it can go on and will go on because it's the room. It's just a story. And when I turn around and look at it, what's funny about these stories? They kind of wither and shrivel up, you know? It's a thought. Give it a go.
Yes, Liz.
Thanksgiving coming? Mm-hmm. And with the ending of the election, we're getting together with a lot of family members all coming in. And we have a very divided family. And so I so deeply appreciate this conversation today because I just feel like I'm filling my toolbox right now with these things that are going to be very helpful. But speaking of a room and then when we were talking about, you know, when you have those moments of, Andrew, you know, when you were saying that you're quiet, that's what I'll typically do. I'll just sit very quietly, which is not what I'll do typically when our family's together. And I don't want anyone to ask me what's going on because I know if I do speak, it is not going to be kind or loving. It could be very filled with a lot of anger or sadness. And so what I have found is if things are going on around me that I can feel it coming up in me, I go to the bathroom. Nobody questions me. I'm not offending anybody. I will say it in the middle of a conversation. Ooh, hang on. And I will go sit in the bathroom and meditate in the bathroom. Because unless I find that space that I can create that energy for myself, it is very difficult for me when I'm in it. It's like a vortex that I can feel myself being sucked into. And I'm standing there thinking, I'm in such pain right now. And it feels terrible. But when I can go into that bathroom and it's just me, sometimes I'll run the water so I can hear the water and I'll run it over my hands. I can come back to who I am. And I can go out there and feel like, oh my gosh, I did it. You know, I can actually have these conversations or sit at the table and not feel like I'm about ready to explode. So, I mean, I just wanted to share that because it's been so deeply helpful for me, especially right now when the energy is just like, oh, and now we're all getting together. Oh, here we go. You know, so thank you. Thank you all. Thank you.
Yeah, so additional sharings, Evelyn.
Well, just to add to that, when you're in the bathroom, if you go back to that all blame into one, you realize you're the person that invited that person to dinner that upset you. So when you go back to that, it's about me, it softens it.
Thank you. Yeah, so again, inviting questions or inviting just any sharings that you may have, all about deep listening and loving speech and how we as a community can support each other with our ideas, our practice. Yes, Eleanor.
If this topic was chosen before Tuesday or after Tuesday?
Well, I have a really funny answer for you.
Well, let me hear it.
Because I moderated the last topic, which was number 2. And so we were going to do the third one that has more to do with sexual conduct, but we thought, we're kind of an older group up here. The young people, a lot of them are in the Dharma Transmission Retreat this weekend, so, but it worked out, right?
So it was fortuitous. I just want to say, I'm so grateful for the Sangha. I'm so grateful for the Dharma. It's just, I've been a person who has been passionately politically active since 1965. So you can imagine. But somehow or other, I have been rather calm during this, and I know it comes from this teachings. I could not have done this otherwise. And, you know, on Facebook, what I'm seeing, and of course, this is mostly family, the one thing I'm seeing is people saying, let's be kind, let's be positive. And I'm so encouraged by that. And I too am getting together with all my family and over Thanksgiving. And it will be very interesting, quite different than yours, because in my family, there's the progressives and the more progressives. So we don't have that other side. But I've in speaking with my brother, who's also a very spiritual person, we're the elders now, and you know, we've even discussed this, how important it is for us to be calm and to listen. And that's why I'm so glad we talked about that today, the listening, because I forget about that. I start out with it, but I forget about that. So I'm just really, really encouraged, and I feel I probably done more practicing this past week than ever since I became a part of the Sangha, and I'm just so grateful for this practice. I think I might be in a mental hospital right now if it weren't for this.
Thank you. I think we probably have time for one more question or sharing, if anyone would like to. This is Celeste.
Thank you for everything that I when you're practicing deep listening with someone and they are upset about, say, the election, and you're sort of commiserating with them, you're really trying to be with them. So, yes, I feel that you're really upset about this. When do you know when it's appropriate to sort of guide them toward, well, let's think about having not fighting hate with hate? Or, you know, how do you say that without also still not being with them anymore? Does that make sense? Do you know what I mean?
How do you guide them toward a more rational stance? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or do you even need to? Because that's kind of the opposite of being with them, with their feeling. You know what I mean? Like validating them.
That's part of deep listening, is listening so you know when to speak or if to speak. Sometimes you don't speak. I remember being with a guy in a park in Canada, and I was just admiring this beautiful, beautiful park, and the people were playing, and the families were out, and it was such a beautiful day, and this guy comes up and sits down and starts telling me about his Canadian politics and how the city was going to pot and how this was going to pot, and this park was, you know, being run over by, you know, derelicts and all that, and, you know, and I just at that day was sort of like watching a movie and just listened to him. And I just listened to him. And then he finally stopped. He got quiet. And he said, don't listen to me. I'm just in a bad mood.
Also, what comes to mind is my inclination to want to get out of my discomfort and listening to their pain. So deep listening is a place of also being aware of my own suffering as well as theirs.
Well, thank you. This has been a very rich sharing with the panelists and with each of you. So thank you for joining us for this morning.